From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The claim that they were trying to protect their agents is totally disingenuous. It's undoubted that there are hundreds, if not thousands or even millions, of files and photos and emails in the CIA's possession that, if leaked, would disclose or reveal the identity of CIA agents. And we don't assume that the CIA is going around destroying every single one of those files.
The CIA destroys at least two videotapes documenting prisoner interrogations at a secret CIA prison. What were they trying to cover up? But first, millions of homeowners face foreclosure.
We should not bail out lenders, real estate speculators, or those who made the reckless decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford.
Reckless? We'll speak with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He's leading a march on Wall Street today. And how is the private military firm Blackwater playing a role in the presidential race?
I'm not going to specify the specific means of what is and what is not torture so that the people that we capture will know what things we're able to do and what things we're not able to do. I get that advice from Kofor Black.
Kofor Black, the former head of counterterrorism at the CIA, is now the vice chair of Blackwater. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency have launched a joint probe into the CIA's destruction of at least two videotapes documenting prisoner interrogations at a secret CIA prison. One of the tapes may have shown CIA agents waterboarding the al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah. CIA Director Michael Hayden said the videos were made in 2002 but destroyed in 2005 because they posed a security risk. Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch questioned the CIA's motives.
Well, we know that these were tapes taken during a time where the CIA was using techniques like waterboarding, a technique that several Republican senators, among many others, have now declared illegal. It seems as if the CIA was engaged in destruction of evidence of a crime scene, and that's very concerning.
CBS Evening News is reporting a well-informed source informed the network that the CIA destroyed the interrogation videos to avoid criminal prosecution. Meanwhile, new questions are being raised about the role of senior lawmakers in backing the alleged torture. The Washington Post reports the CIA has regularly briefed senior members of the House and Senate intelligence committees on its secret overseas prisons and the interrogation techniques used there since 2002. The lawmakers include four Democrats, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Congressmember Jane Harman, and Senators Bob Graham and John Rockefeller. Republicans briefed included then-Congressmember Porter Goss and Senator Pat Roberts. According to the Washington Post, none of the lawmakers raised objections, and at least two of them asked the CIA to push harder. CIA officials say the controversial practice of waterboarding was among the techniques on display. Former Vice President Al Gore and the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change received the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo today for their work to help combat global warming. At a news conference ahead of the awards ceremony, Gore said the survival of our civilization is at risk.
One of the Nobel laureates, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., said 20 years ago and more that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. In the same way, CO2 increases anywhere are a threat to the future of civilization everywhere.
While Al Gore and the IPCC received the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, negotiators continued to meet in Bali at the UN climate talks. The Guardian newspaper reports the negotiations hit a potential problem today when the United States said it is unwilling to approve a draft agreement setting firm targets for cuts to carbon pollution. The Bush administration says a proposal for developed nations to reduce emissions by between 25% and 40% by 2020 is, quote, totally unrealistic and unhelpful. The 25-40% figure is based on the work of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Harlan Watson, the senior climate negotiator for the U.S., said the IPCC calculation was based on many uncertainties. Meanwhile, a new report by the climate research group German Watch has ranked the United States the second worst industrial nation in the world when it comes to combating climate change. Of the 56 nations ranked, the United States came in a second to last, ahead of only Saudi Arabia. Sweden ranked first on the list. The ranking is based on energy use and carbon dioxide emissions data and on an evaluation of the climate change policies in place in each country. In campaign news, a new survey by Newsweek shows former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee has taken a commanding lead in Iowa in the Republican race for the White House. 39% of likely Republican caucus goers say they plan to vote for Huckabee. Mitt Romney came in second with 17%. Huckabee's popularity has surged in recent months. A Newsweek poll in late September showed Huckabee having just 6% of the vote in Iowa. Meanwhile, more details about Huckabee's record are emerging. The Associated Press has revealed the ordained Southern Baptist minister once advocated isolating AIDS patients from the general public and opposed increased federal funding in the search for a cure to AIDS. Huckabee made the statements to the AP in 1992 when he was running for the U.S. Senate. Huckabee wrote, "If the federal government is truly serious about doing something with the AIDS virus, we need to take steps that would isolate the carriers of this plague." Huckabee also wrote at the time, quote, "I feel homosexuality is an aberrant, unnatural, and sinful lifestyle, and we now know it can pose a dangerous public health risk." In other campaign news, talk show host Oprah Winfrey campaigned with Senator Barack Obama in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina this weekend. On Sunday, nearly 30,000 people gathered to hear Winfrey and Obama speak in Columbia, South Carolina, in what the Obama campaign described as the largest campaign event on the 2008 race. A day earlier, 18,000 people gathered in Iowa to see Senator Obama and Oprah Winfrey.
Obama has fought for disability pay for veterans. He worked to boost the non-proliferation of deadly weapons. He advocated the use of alternative fuels to cure our national addiction to oil. He has spoken out against our government's indifference to the poor and to political incompetence in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And he has rallied against genocide in Darfur. And long before it was the popular thing to do, he stood with clarity and conviction against this war in Iraq.
Oprah Winfrey in Iowa. The United States was accused this weekend of being hypocritical for supporting Israel's right to have nuclear weapons while trying to force Iran to stop uranium enrichment. During a conference in the Gulf nation of Bahrain, the Bahraini labor minister Majid Al-Alawi questioned Defense Secretary Robert Gates about Israel.
Secretary of Defense, thank you very much for the excellent speech. I was wondering whether you think the Israeli nuclear weapon is a threat to the region's security or not.
I'm sorry.
Whether the Israeli nuclear weapon is a threat to the region's security.
No, I do not.
The statement by Gates was greeted by laughter from a room filled with government officials from Middle Eastern countries. Gates said there are significant differences in terms of both the history and the behavior of the Iranian and Israeli governments.
I think that Israel is not training terrorists to subvert its neighbors. It is not, it has not shipped weapons into a place like Iraq to kill thousands of innocent civilians covertly. It has not carried out a number. It has not threatened to destroy any of its neighbors. It is not trying to destabilize the government of Lebanon.
In news from Iraq, the police chief of the province of Babel was killed Sunday in a roadside bomb. The attack occurred just hours after U.S. commanders praised Qais al-Mamouri for his commitment to bringing stability to Iraq. In the Iraqi city of Basra, police officials are reporting religious vigilantes have killed at least 40 women this year because of how they dress. Basra's police chief, Jaleel Khalaf, told the Associated Press, "The women of Basra are being horrifically murdered and then dumped in the garbage with notes saying they were killed for un-Islamic behavior. He said women are regularly accosted for not wearing traditional dress and headscarves. In other Iraq news, a criminal hearing was held on Sunday in Baghdad in the case of imprisoned Associated Press photographer Bilal Hussein, who has been held by the U.S. military without charge for nearly 20 months. The hearing marked the first time Hussein or his attorneys have seen any evidence in the case. No formal charges have been lodged yet against Hussein, who was part of a team of AP photographers who won a Pulitzer Prize. Last week, the Committee to Protect Journalists said Hussein is one of at least 127 journalists behind bars worldwide. China's currently jailing 29 journalists, more than any other country. The United States is jailing two journalists without charge, Bilal Hussein in Iraq and Al Jazeera cameraman Sami Alhaj, who's been held at Guantanamo Bay for more than 5 years. The city of Chicago has agreed to pay nearly $20 million to four former death row prisoners who gave false confessions after being tortured by Chicago police. The four men are all African American. They sued former Chicago police commander John Burge and more than 20 officers who worked with him, alleging they were coerced into falsely confessing to murder. In 2006, special prosecutors released a long-awaited report stating there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Burge and four other former officers abused suspects to extract confessions in the 1980s. Charges have never been filed against John Burge, who oversaw the torture. He was fired in 1993, but is still receiving a $30,000 a year police pension from the city. Meanwhile, in other news from Chicago, the investigative reporter who was most responsible for uncovering the police torture story has been laid off. John Conroy was one of four reporters at the Chicago Reader dismissed last week in a cost-saving measure by the paper's parent company, Creative Loafing. Conroy had been covering the torture story since 1990. And in Argentina, Cristina Kirchner is to be sworn in today as the country's first elected female president, succeeding her husband, Néstor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Yes, I'm homeless. I might as well be dead. Oh, yes, I'm hungry and I'm hungry and I might as well be dead. I'm hungry and disgusted. No place to lay my head. So high mountain hill. Then I went and stood upon so high and lonesome hill. Then I looked down on my house, on the place where I used to live. Now I wish I was an eagle, oh, but I'm a plane.
Odetta, Homeless Blues, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nation's housing crisis has been called the biggest immediate threat facing the U.S. economy today. Amidst growing unease, President Bush announced a plan last week to freeze interest rates for some homeowners facing foreclosure. But critics say the plan's strict guidelines will leave out the most vulnerable. The Center for Responsible Lending says Bush's plan will only help about 7% of subprime borrowers, or about 100 145,000 families. A subprime loan offers borrowers a mortgage, but at a disproportionately high rate they often can't afford. The subprime market has fueled a record 1 million foreclosures this year, with an estimated 2 million expected in 2008. A growing coalition of housing and civil rights advocates are calling for federal intervention to protect homeowners from foreclosures. Today, those calls are coming to the hub of the lenders and investors behind them. Demonstrators will gather in the heart of Wall Street for a march dubbed Save Our Homes, Fight Home Foreclosures, Defend Our Economic Rights. The Reverend Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push Coalition have helped organize today's march. Reverend Jackson joins me now in the Firehouse studio, just blocks from where he'll lead the rally at noon today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is indeed a huge economic crisis. It is sinking banks around the world. Goldman Sachs says a $2 trillion plus impact could put us into a long-term economic recession. So we're not just saving the home borrowers, we're not saving the entire economy.
Who's at fault here?
The bankers who precipitated and abused the subprime loan. What was a scheme became a scam. The rationale at first, Amy, was that for people at low credit score, sometimes artificially low, I might add, this was a way to get them loans. But this was abused rather quickly. You have evidence of redlining and targeting and steering. Targeting seniors, for example, who were on fixed incomes, and to refinance beyond their ability to pay. Sometimes we're not giving good information about escrow, where they pay on interest but not pay on, you know, taxes and insurance, that type thing, and taking seniors from the predators, take you home, the vultures buy you out. But by now, I was in Prince George's County this weekend, 13,100 former foreclosures in one county. Impact of $3 billion loss in value, the size of the entire county's budget. It's a big deal.
President Bush made his announcement dealing with the crisis on Thursday.
Rise in foreclosures would have negative consequences for our economy. Lenders and investors would face enormous losses. So they have an interest in supporting mortgage counseling and working with homeowners to prevent foreclosure. The government has a role to play as well. We should not bail out lenders, real estate speculators, or those who made the reckless decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford. Yet there are some responsible homeowners who could avoid foreclosure with some assistance.
That is President Bush speaking on Thursday. Reckless, Reverend Jackson?
He offers an umbrella when we need a tent, number one. We put together a Reconstruction Finance Corporation to bail America out of the Great Depression. Similar Resolutions Trust Corporation, the SNLs in the 1990s. This thing is so big, it's beyond, in some sense, blame. The house is on fire. You can't focus on the five bugs today. You need ladders and windows. We also must have some kind of reconstruction corporation where the most egregious violators like Countrywide would invest in such a fund. In the meantime, you're looking at record levels of evictions and foreclosures. And when you cannot pay taxes, it undermines schools and public transportation and health care. And that's why the government has a role to play. Bush recognizes a role to play. He covers maybe 7% and leaves 93% out in the rain. We need a much more massive approach than this by our federal government, a kind of mortgage Marshall Plan.
You're targeting Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, and Bear Stearns. Why these?
Well, it's not just them. We're saying that Wall Street had a role to play in the subprime lending scheme. And they then loaned not the people, but they loaned to the predators, who then dealt with the brokers, who then set up the people. And so it is so big. So without government regulation of the banks, without transparency, it was open season on the people. And so the government has a role to play because its lack of diligence allowed the banks to run amok to get these fast profits. And then the banks used their freedom, in fact, to set up this abusive subprime scams on, I might add, a lot of targeting, racial targeting, for example, in Michigan, 20% white, 40% Latino, 55% African American. A lot of targeting went on. A lot of seniors targeted in this process. So our march simply says today in New York, we want massive restructuring over repossession of homes, restructuring of loans, not repossession of homes. And we're marching in New York today on the LaSalle Street in Chicago at the Federal Reserve Bank, at Countrywide in Atlanta, Georgia, at Countrywide in LA. Around the country, people are now fighting back, saying borrowers do not surrender, fight back.
Now, you're asking these banks to give back, to put into, calling on investment banks to donate holiday bonuses to foreclosure prevention fund?
Indeed, because they should not be making huge profits at the expense of people who are losing their homes, because they made profits based upon this exploitative scheme. And Mr. Greenspan said he did not recognize, he didn't see this coming. Well, it's an economic tsunami. We see it coming now. Lest we move quickly with some kind of government infrastructure, you're looking at 3.5 million homes in foreclosure, maybe another 7 million that are in subprime loans. Its impact on cities, on small towns will be absolutely devastating. We're going to pay to not save the people's homes. Better that we pay to keep people in their homes over long-term interest, restructured loans as opposed to repossession of homes en masse.
One of the places that you're going to, Reverend Jackson, is your hometown, Chicago. How has it affected Chicago?
30,000 homes in foreclosure, 80,000 with late payments, and they just keep, and you can see the target, you can see the neighborhoods that have been targeted and set up in this way. Sometimes people are given deals where it was beyond their ability to pay, and they inflated their ability to pay because they were lack set up to do so. In other instances, we see seniors targeting who were offered products that they cannot afford to pay, but they made false promises. At some point, Amy, you must be able to trust your doctor or trust your bank. When trust breaks down, tyranny sets in.
Do you see subprime as a crime? Do you see the whole scandal?
The scandal is a subprime scheme. What was a scheme is now a scandal. The original idea in 1980 was that a significant body of people who could not afford conventional loans because sometimes artificially low credit score, sometimes artificially kind of driven down. But and the idea was to make available loans to them. Early on, however, what was a help became exploitation, and now it has run amok. And if in fact we don't stop it, its impact upon why is Schwarzenegger involved in California convening Countrywide and others? Because it's going to sink his economy. Why are mayors involved? Because mayor cities will go down the tube unless we in fact make a massive move. So Mr. Bush's plan is too little and very late. And not, it does not correspond to the size of the problem. So for the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, it brought us out of the Depression. It's bigger than that, by the way. The numbers are much bigger. A Resolution Trust Corporation out of the S&L crisis. Now we need a Resolution Trust Mortgage Corporation to bail us out of this situation. People pay back for over a longer period of time.
The comparison to the Marshall Plan?
It's comprehensive. When Europe could not make it back on conventional rates, we made available to Europe 50-year loans at 2% government secured. We bail out the economy. It helped Europe. It gave us a market. It gave us a strong defense. It gave us allies. We thought bigger than one bucket of water trying to dip an ocean. We thought in big terms. Reconstruction finance, we thought in big terms. That's why I hope that those who are running for presidency, all of whom have some idea, some plan, but they need to make this issue of bailing out American homeowners and bailing out cities as central to the campaigns. So we know everybody wants to get out of Iraq, and the question is who says what, when, how soon. We must put the same kind of focus we put on Iraq now on our own economy, which is in between the debt to China and this long-term recession we're looking at and the Iraq war, it will sink our economy.
Let me ask you, you mentioned the candidates, about the candidates. The fellow Chicagoan Oprah Winfrey was in Iowa, New Hampshire, in South Carolina, campaigning for Barack Obama, the largest campaign rally in this campaign happened in South Carolina,
maybe
something
ever.
Like 30,000, right, maybe,
yeah,
in history. In Iowa, 18,000 people came out. How significant is this?
It's a big deal. As you look at Oprah as a key campaigner for Barack and Bill for Hillary in this instance, it remains to determine will these crowds see this as entertainment or involvement, and that becomes key. I think Oprah may have the edge in that polls are not polling new or unexpected voters. If new and unexpected voters turn their enthusiasm into voting, they have a big impact. And that remains to be seen. But it is significant to involve people in the process. People are now arguing politics, arguing leadership, fighting for who has the best plan to end the war in Iraq, who has the best plan indeed to deal with urban policy, the best plan to restore health care. And I would hope that this involvement will carry over into turnout in the campaign and into 08 November.
Does any of their plans satisfy you in getting out of Iraq?
Yes, but we started late. But I think there's now almost a consensus that this war was an error, that we were lied to, no weapons of mass destruction, no al-Qaeda connection, no imminent threat. And we built a house on sand. Now we've lost lives, money, and honor. So there's a kind of consensus now that we should get out of Iraq as quickly as we can with some process of bringing someone in, because we got in by ourselves, basically. We can't get out by ourselves.
Are you endorsing a candidate?
Well, I'm supporting Barack as a candidate, but I'm not campaigning for anyone, because I've tried to be focused on putting forth the issues that matter to all of them. I've maintained open lines of communication with Hillary, with Barack, with Kucinich, with all of them, because right now I think what's missing, Amy, is a real focus on how to bail us out of this calamity of the subprime crisis, which is so big. The need for an urban policy with bridges are collapsing and levees are breaking, schools are falling down. And thirdly, the need to focus on the emergency state of Black America. You know, 2 million Americans in jail, 1 million are Black. Then in New Jersey, 60% of Blacks are expelled more often than whites. I mean, the impact of the abandoned urban policy and isolating of Black Americans is a big deal. Let me say this to you quickly. This whole economic subprime crisis comes because we ignored the civil rights of the Black, the brown, and the poor. The water came in at the bottom of the ship, and that's up around the deck and up around the captain's table. So we pay a big price for not civil rights protection of all Americans.
This latest news, City of Chicago agreeing to pay nearly $20 million to four former death row prisoners who gave false confessions after being tortured by Chicago police, led by the police commander, John Burge.
It's our own Abu Ghraib, and there's been too little commitment to, in fact, deal with it. My son, Jonathan Jackson, focused on this issue for months on end now, because there are more torture victims still on death row. The sticky wicket of it is that Mayor Daley was the state's attorney when John Burge did these tortured confessions. And if it really unravels, it's going to involve a lot of Chicagoans. This is an ugly set of international crimes that must not be ignored any longer.
Finally, this latest news that's just come out, the leadership of the Democratic and Republican Party in the House and Senate, Nancy Pelosi, Jay Rockefeller, and others, were briefed early on about torture. And according to the Washington Post, they not only didn't stop it, they condoned it in top-level, you know, secret intelligence briefings.
I'm disappointed. And that may be why, when the issue of torture came up with the new attorney general, they were so mum. Because in some states they were complicit in the process. We must have an ethical standard that we espouse and that we also live by. We cannot compromise our ethical standards and our dignity for short-term politics. We deserve better than that.
So you're going to be out on Wall Street today?
Today, exchange and broad at high noon in Wall Street in New York, LaSalle Street in Chicago, in Peachtree Street in Atlanta, Georgia. Around that, we're going to stop marching and not stop until we, in fact, stop evictions, stop foreclosures, and choose long-term restructuring of loans over repossession of people's homes en masse. We cannot afford it, and it's not right morally.
Reverend Jackson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll talk about Blackwater. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish. Over 150 radio stations are taking them. You can, too. You can just go to our website at democracynow.org. As we turn now to the latest in the unfolding controversy surrounding the private military contractor Blackwater. On Friday, the State Department's top investigator was forced to resign. Following the disclosure, his brother sat on Blackwater's advisory board. Inspector General Howard Krongard had initially denied his brother's ties to the company. Current and former State Department officials have previously accused Krongard of thwarting probes into contracting waste and crimes in Iraq, including alleged arms smuggling by Blackwater guards. Meanwhile, after initially indicating it would let Blackwater's contract expire in May, State Department officials are now raising the likelihood of a renewal. The acting head of U.S. diplomatic security, Gregory Starr, has reportedly told Blackwater it'll be judged on its actions, quote, from here on out. That would preclude from consideration the September shooting deaths of 17 Iraqi civilians by Blackwater guards in Baghdad. In his latest piece in The Nation magazine, independent journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill writes that Blackwater isn't taking any chances on keeping its lucrative deals. Scahill says Blackwater has launched a major rebranding campaign aimed at winning new government contracts for far beyond Iraq. And it's also playing a role in the presidential race, establishing deep ties to Republican hopeful Mitt Romney. Jeremy Scahill joins me now in the Firehouse studio, author of the best-selling book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks, Amy.
Well, let's take these one by one. First, Krongard resigning. How significant is this, and who was he?
Well, this is very significant. I mean, Cookie Krongard, as his nickname was, Howard Krongard, was the top official at the State Department responsible for investigating waste, fraud, and abuse. And he was directly responsible for investigating Blackwater, because Blackwater works for the U.S. State Department. One of the original scandals that erupted with Krongard was when Henry Waxman raised the prospect that Krongard had been stifling a Justice Department criminal investigation into allegations that Blackwater was involved in some kind of an arms smuggling operation in Iraq. Krongard, instead of assigning a seasoned liaison to work with the Justice Department from the State Department, actually assigned his congressional liaison and media person. And Waxman says that that ultimately caused a delay of about 2 weeks in the investigation. So he was already under fire at the time. Now, I have to say, before Cookie Krongard appeared before Waxman's committee a couple of weeks ago, where it was revealed that his brother, Alvin Buzzy Krongard, was in fact a paid consultant to Blackwater, had accepted a position as a paid consultant to Blackwater on the company's advisory board, the Krongards were familiar to me. I, in fact, had written in my book about Buzzy Krongard. He wasn't just a guy who joined Blackwater's advisory board as a paid consultant in the midst of this scandal. He was one of the central people at the Central Intelligence Agency responsible for getting Eric Prince's men from Blackwater into the mercenary business. Buzzy Krongard, at the time that Blackwater jumped into the mercenary business in 2002, shortly after 9/11, he was the number three man at the CIA, the executive director. He was a hunting buddy of Eric Prince, and he was the one who got Blackwater, was central to getting Blackwater its first mercenary contract that we know of, which was a $5 million black contract to go into Afghanistan in the aftermath of 9/11. Eric Prince went over with that initial team. So there was a prolonged five-plus-year relationship between Blackwater and the brother of the man who then would ultimately be responsible for investigating potential crimes or allegations of misconduct on the part of Blackwater. Now, an interesting side note to this is that apparently the Krongard brothers hate each other, and they actually have tried to wheel that out as a defense in this case. But it would be an extraordinary coincidence that the man responsible at the CIA for getting Blackwater into the mercenary business with the U.S. government, his brother just happens to be the guy investigating the company, or supposed to be investigating the company, and accused of failing to do so at the very moment when a cornucopia of scandals present themselves.
now, after initially indicating that it would let Blackwater's contract expire in May, the State Department is now saying, acting head of U.S. diplomatic security, Gregory Starr, that Blackwater will be judged on its actions from here on out.
Well, then that probably means that a lot of Blackwater people will be going to jail. I mean, the reality is that, and that's not going to happen. The reality is that on December 3rd, Blackwater released a job posting seeking snipers and more protective security specialists because of an extension of its State Department contract. So apparently, Blackwater knows something that has not been revealed publicly because they're hiring new guards under their WPPS contract, their State Department contract, which is how they work in Iraq.
Let's go to the campaign. I want to play Mitt Romney's comments at the Republican CNN YouTube debate last month. In an exchange with Senator John McCain, Romney refused to say whether he thinks waterboarding is torture.
I did not say, and I do not say, that we're in that I'm in favor of torture. I am not. I'm not going to specify the specific means of what is and what is not torture so that the people that we capture will know what things we're able to do and what things we're not able to do. I get that advice from Kofor Black, who is a person who was responsible for counterterrorism in the CIA for some 35 years. I get that advice by talking to former generals in our military, and I don't believe it's appropriate for me as a presidential candidate to lay out all of the issues one by one, get questioned one by one. Is this torture? Is that torture?
Mitt Romney, Jeremy Scahill.
Right. Well, it's interesting that Mitt Romney brings up Kofor Black and wheels him out in his defense of his refusal to label waterboarding torture and says, we're not going to tell the enemies what we're going to do to them when I'm president. Anyone who knows anything about the career of Kofor Black, who's the number two man at Blackwater, the head of their new private intelligence company called Total Intelligence Solutions, none of the things that Mitt Romney is saying will come as a surprise. For much of the past year, Kofor Black, who currently remains the number two man, the vice chairman of Blackwater worldwide. He's been Mitt Romney's senior advisor on counterterrorism. And so when you hear Mitt Romney refuse to call waterboarding torture and say things like we're not going to talk about the tactics we're going to use and call for a doubling of Guantanamo, you have to understand that the man who's telling him to say these things, who's advising him on these policies, is one of the biggest thugs to serve in U.S. government. I mean, and the other thing is that Kofor Black, what Mitt Romney said about him was a dramatic exaggeration. He said he ran he was responsible for counterterrorism at the CIA for 35 years. Well, first of all, Black was only in the CIA for 28 years, and he only ran the counterterrorism program for three of those. But nonetheless, Kofor Black was in charge of counterterrorism at one of the most crucial times in recent history. On 9/11, it was Kofor Black who was head of the CIA's counterterrorism center. This is a man who was seemingly obsessed with corporal mutilation. He would talk about having flies crawling across the eyeballs of America's enemies, putting skulls on pikes, whacking off heads with machetes, bringing severed heads back in cardboard boxes on dry ice of bin Laden to present to President Bush. He was the man responsible for escalating the use of Bill Clinton's extraordinary rendition program, the U.S. government-sanctioned kidnap and torture program. And now he apparently is one of the key people in the Romney campaign. I mean, if Mitt Romney became president, it raises the prospect of Blackwater's lucrative business under Bush looking like a church bake sale.
How significant is Kofor Black to Mitt Romney's campaign?
I think he's incredibly significant. And the fact is that when John McCain goes after Mitt Romney on this issue, which McCain has been pretty forceful on, having been tortured himself, and one of the only Republicans who really is speaking out against it in a clear way, the fact that he tries to wheel out Kofor Black in response to McCain saying, well, you should talk to people like Colin Powell, indicates that not only does Romney get his advice from Kofor Black, but he seems to want to use him as a propaganda tool as well. And let's be clear here. Kofor Black, while working with the Romney campaign, also is running a private intelligence company, Total Intelligence Solutions, is one of the key people behind the scenes at Blackwater, and one of the major figures in this world of private security and private intelligence, one of the dons of the industry.
Jeremy Scahill, talk about the rebranding of Blackwater.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the industry itself, the mercenary industry, has been engaged in a rebranding campaign to take this old dirty profession of soldiers for hire and remake it as a peacekeeping operation. Blackwater's undergone a major overhaul of its website. It's no longer called Blackwater USA. It's called Blackwater Worldwide. Their logo, which used to be a bear paw and a sniper scope, is now a bear paw surrounded by two half ovals. It almost looks reminiscent of the United Nations logo. No longer are Blackwater mercenaries referred to even as personal security operatives or personal security details. They're global stabilization professionals. So the terms that are being wheeled out on the Blackwater website, you can purchase a teddy bear with a Blackwater t-shirt on it, a onesie for your infant. It comes in both blue and pink. And recently, Blackwater paratroopers staged a dramatic aerial landing, not in Baghdad or Kabul, but in San Diego, at halftime of the San Diego State BYU football game, where they came down in parachutes with the Blackwater flag. They actually, at one point, inadvertently dragged the American flag on the ground, which has gotten the attention of some bloggers. And it's interesting that Blackwater did this in San Diego, their paratroopers landing on the field, because they're fighting back major, fierce local resistance to their attempt to open an 824-acre mercenary camp based right on the U.S.-Mexico border. But Blackwater's business, in many ways, Amy, has never been better. They're being considered for part of a $15 billion contract with the Pentagon to operate in the so-called war on drugs. They recently got a $92 million contract to operate flights for the Pentagon in Central Asia. The intelligence company is growing. They have a maritime division with a 184-foot vessel that has been fitted for paramilitary use. They recently flew their unmanned airship called the Polar 400, which they're marketing to the Department of Homeland Security. And also they're
along
making...
Along the border?
To monitor the U.S.-Mexico border. But they're also saying it could be used by government and non-government entities alike. They also are making an armored vehicle called the Grizzly, which they're sort of portraying as the most versatile armored vehicle in history, combining the durability of an armored vehicle with the versatility of an SUV. And Eric Prince intends to have that vehicle modified so that it would be legal for use on U.S. highways and roads.
Potrero, where this controversy is taking place, whether they'll set up a base there. Blackwater use the fires in California, help some people out there.
Right. Well, I mean, look, Blackwater really jumped into the domestic operations component of its business in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. They started a whole new division of the company for domestic operations. I think Blackwater sees disaster response as a gateway, one of the gateways, into a massive Homeland Security budget. And the Department of Homeland Security, like all agencies of the federal government, is being radically privatized. 70% of the U.S. national intelligence budget, 16 intelligence agencies, 70% of that budget is in the hands of private contractors. The Border Patrol faces the prospect of being privatized. DynCorp, one of Blackwater's competitors, has said it wants to put boots on the ground as privatized Border Patrol. Blackwater is a very innovative, cutting-edge company, and they are sticking their fingers into every pot that they can get them into. And Homeland Security is a major one, and one of the gateways into it, like Darfur for international peacekeeping, is to say, we can be the first responders. We can respond to the hurricanes, the floods, the fires. It's a gateway.
And what is the problem you see with that?
Well, there's a number of problems. I mean, first of all, it raises serious constitutional questions about, are the civil liberties of individuals being protected that Blackwater comes in contact with? But on a deeper level, it has to do with how we distribute resources in this country. If the poor are left to drown and starve, and the rich can then hire their private fire departments or have private utilities, that means that in this country, you have to be a person of means to be entitled to services that the government normally provides. And so this radical privatization agenda ultimately is a pulling out of the rug from the most needy people in the society.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater. Scott Horton also joins us. He teaches law at Columbia Law School. He participates in the blog No Comment at Harper's Magazine and was the chair of the International Law Committee at the New York Bar Association. What do you see as the issue of Blackwater here, the problem of Blackwater here?
Well, I think Jeremy puts his finger right on it. It really is. It's a massive privatization of national security operation, including intelligence operations. But we have a major aspect of it that's now in focus in Congress, and that's the accountability problem. If we look at the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq today, we see that U.S. men and women in uniform, if they do something wrong, there's a proper accountability process for it, including discipline and court-martial. If it's Blackwater or if it's another contractor, nothing happens. It's effective impunity. And in fact, we have thousands of recorded incidents out there that have gone without punishment of any kind. At most, the employee who's involved gets fired and sent back to the States, but then frequently enough, they're back on another plane, back working for a different contractor in Iraq or Afghanistan within a matter of weeks.
And Jeremy, the status of the September 16th killings that took place in Baghdad.
Where 17 Iraqis were killed, 24 others wounded, and actually those some of the victims' families and survivors are suing Blackwater not just for wrongful death, but for war crimes under the Alien Tort Statute. And what's interesting now is that there is a federal grand jury that's been convened, and we understand it's looking at a number of cases, not just at this case, but some witnesses and potentially people who are who were involved with the shooting in Nisr Square have testified in front of the grand jury. And we understand from media reports, this is a grand jury that was convened in Washington, D.C., we understand from media reports, and maybe Scott can add to this, that there potentially could be an attempt to prosecute as many as three of the Blackwater individuals involved at Nisr Square. And the way that they would most likely be prosecuted is under U.S. civilian law called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, essentially saying that if contractors commit a crime abroad, they can be prosecuted criminally for that at home. The problem is that the law was written in a way that it applies only to contractors accompanying the armed forces or working directly for the armed forces. Blackwater works for the State Department, and so some legal observers say it's like trying to cram a square into a circle. And if they go forward with this prosecution under a law that doesn't exactly appear to apply to Blackwater, that it ultimately could be a step backwards. Now, Congress is trying to amend that so that it would apply to Blackwater, but it can't be applied retroactively. And many of the legal experts I've talked to say there almost literally is no law that could be applied to Blackwater except war crimes. And that, I mean, that's something that Scott has been looking
at. Scott Martin.
Well, that's exactly correct. Let's just say first, if they go forward with this prosecution, this would be the first time ever that the Department of Justice has prosecuted a security contractor in Iraq with respect to a crime involving violence against locals. That's never happened before, notwithstanding thousands of incidents. If they do it and they go forward with the prosecution on the basis of the media alone, then I think there is, you know, there's a serious question as to whether or not it's going to apply. I'm not quite sure I come out exactly where Jeremy does. I think there is a basis for saying that it'll cover them. The question is not whether they're DOD contractors, but whether or not they're involved in the contingency operation. And there, of course, they're going to say that their function is just to provide security for Department of State personnel. But I think you could look at it fairly and say, no, they're really a part of this overall operation in Iraq. But the bottom line is really it's a war crime question. There clearly is jurisdiction and a basis to act against them under the War Crimes Act, but the Bush administration doesn't want to go there, doesn't want to touch that. I think they've made that point clear.
Well, we're going to leave it here. I want to thank you very much, Jeremy Scahill, for joining us, author of the best-selling book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Scott Horton, I'd like you to stay after break as we talk about the CIA tapes that the CIA has destroyed of interrogations. Stay with us.
Understanding of my
World Leader Pretend, REM, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department and the Central Intelligence Agency have launched a joint probe into the CIA's destruction of at least two tapes documenting prisoner interrogations at a secret CIA prison. CIA Director Michael Hayden said the tapes were destroyed because they posed a serious security risk. Hayden says if they were to become public, they would have exposed CIA officials and their families to retaliation from al-Qaeda and its sympathizers. But critics have accused the CIA of deliberately destroying evidence that could have been used to hold agents accountable for the torture of prisoners. One of the tapes is believed to have shown CIA agents waterboarding the al-Qaeda operative Abu Zubaydah. Defense lawyers for Guantanamo prisoners say the destruction of the tapes could open new challenges in cases based largely on information Zubaydah gave to interrogators. Meanwhile, new questions are being raised about the role of senior lawmakers in backing the alleged torture. The Washington Post reports the CIA has regularly briefed senior members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees on its secret prisons and the interrogation techniques used there since 2002. The lawmakers include four Democrats, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Congressmember Jane Harman, Senators Bob Graham and Jay Rockefeller. CIA officials say the controversial practice of waterboarding was among the techniques on display, but except for one known instance, no lawmaker is said to have voiced objection through the course of some 30 private briefings. Democrats and some Republicans have raised increasing criticism of waterboarding, but only after its use became publicly known. I'm joined now by two guests. Scott Horton is remaining with us, teaches at Columbia Law, is a contributor to Harper's Magazine, where he writes the blog No Comment. Joining me from Washington, Mark Benjamin, national correspondent for Salon.com. His latest piece is called For the CIA's Eyes Only. I want to start here with Scott Horton. Talk about the man that is now being accused of the destruction of the tapes.
Well, it's an interesting point of continuity with your last segment, because the man in the crosshairs here, Jose Rodriguez Jr., was the head of operations at the CIA. He's the man now being fingered as the person who actually authorized the destruction. He has been recruited very aggressively for a period of over a year, according to our sources, by Blackwater. Not surprisingly either, because he was very, very close to Kofor Black, who, of course, is the vice chair of Blackwater. And Kofor Black's name also comes up here over and over again as being right in the middle of this process, leading to the application of these procedures, the preparation of recordings, and then the destruction of the recordings.
Mark Benjamin, your piece asks the question, was the agency's destruction of the video recordings a cover-up? Explain what you understand happened and what you think they're covering up.
Well, the thing that's important to understand about these tapes is that they were made in 2002. And this is a period of time when the CIA in particular, but also the military, are starting to experiment and utilize these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, stress positions, isolation, that sort of business to break people down. So what the CIA did in 2002 is, and we've talked about this on your show before, is enlist a group of psychologists as CIA contractors who know a lot about Cold War methods used by the Soviets and others to break down our soldiers, which include the same techniques. So the agency at that period of time was just starting to use these techniques, with brutal and they're very, very brutal techniques.
You name names in this. You talk about James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. Mitchell and Jessen have that company in Spokane. Can you talk about their involvement, these CIA-employed psychologists?
Well, these people are affiliated with the Survival Escape Resistance Program. It's a military program that over the years has taught U.S. soldiers to resist basically torture if captured, everything from waterboarding to stress positions, these other things that we've discussed. What happened in 2002 is the CIA and the military turned to these psychologists, including those two gentlemen you mentioned, Mitchell and Jessen, to reverse engineer those techniques. So this sort of all wraps together. In other words, these psychologists are providing the CIA with these techniques, starting to provide the military with these techniques, and these are the very techniques that it sounds like are on these videotapes that were destroyed and probably are not something that's very pretty to look at.
And what does this mean right now? It's 2005 that they were destroyed of 2002 interrogations. What do you think happens from here?
Well, it's unclear what happens from here. I mean, that will depend on what the Justice Department decides to do. One of the things that's interesting about 2005 is that at that time, Congress had not passed the Military Commissions Act. That's a late 2006 law, which, among other things, gives people like CIA operatives, some cover, some legal cover for past deeds. In 2005, that didn't exist. So in 2005, the CIA had even more to worry about than it did now, which lends to the optics, at least, that this was, you know, just basically a cover-up of evidence of war crimes.
Do you think that psychologists are on these videotapes?
It's unclear. I mean, we certainly know that at least one of them was in the room at a very early interrogation that looks like it would have been Zubaida or very close to the room. We don't know who's on the tapes, but it certainly is reasonable to believe that they could be.
And where does this fit into the whole struggle within the APA of dissident psychologists? Some of them have resigned at this point, protesting the APA's policy, American Psychological Association's policy, of continuing to allow psychologists to be involved with the interrogations.
Well, it just raises further questions about why the American Psychological Association, as opposed to the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, has been so reticent to just cut itself off from doing these interrogations. It's the only, you know, major medical organization that continues to essentially play ball with the military and the CIA, even though they continue to say that they're not.
Now, I think something like 6 psychology departments at colleges around the country have passed resolutions protesting the APA's position on interrogations.
Yeah, and it's been tearing the organization apart. Yeah, I mean, it's not that the APA is about to go away, but they've, you know, when you go to these meetings, we were at one in San Francisco over the summer. You know, it's an extremely, you know, controversial stance that the APA has taken over the years to continue to participate. And when they participate, you know, on the APA's defense, they say we're not participating in torture, but they continue to use language when they pass resolutions saying they won't participate in torture that looks very similar to language the Bush administration has stuffed in various bills going through Congress that seems to allow them to continue to do it.
Your take on this overall, Scott Horton?
Well, I think that these tapes would have shown the procedures that the APA has described at one point as safe, humane, and legal. Of course, they've argued that psychologists participating in them would make them so. I think it would show just exactly the opposite. But I want to come back to another point. My sources are saying that the destruction actually occurred in mid to late November of 2005. That really puts it in a different context. 2 things going on at that point. One, the Justice Department has decided that it's going to bring criminal charges against Jose Padilla. 2, we have the Massawi case going on in the Eastern District of Virginia. And in that case, Judge Leone Brinkema is pushing, demanding that the government turn over any tapes that existed of interrogation. In fact, I went back and examined transcripts. She is specifically asking about the Al-Zubaida tapes, asking if there are any. And the government's giving her reassurance, no, there are no tapes. We've checked. They say they've relied on certifications from the CIA. Well, those representations are false. So we have false statements made to a court, and we have a clear attempt to evade a court order. That makes it obstruction of justice. That's a crime.
And the fact that Nancy Pelosi, among others in the Democratic leadership, Jay Rockefeller, were briefed on the torture techniques.
Well, that's astonishing, frankly, that there were—
Going way back,
that there was no attempt to record dissents or go to the floor of the House or the Senate and talk about it. I got to really single out Jay Rockefeller here. I mean, to me, we've seen a number of a really dramatic turnaround in positions here, but Jay Rockefeller's one. I mean, he issued 2 press releases on 2 different days in which he took diametrically opposed stances about what happened. One day he was briefed and the next day he wasn't.
On that note, we're going to leave it. Scott Horton, thanks for joining us, teaches law at Columbia Law School, and Mark Benjamin. He's the national correspondent for Salon.com. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.